thank you for listening to another Hastings NAS podcast. We are so pleased that you have shown interest in listening to this podcast, and we pray that it is edifying and beneficial for you. You can watch us live every Sunday morning on Facebook, facebook.com/HastingsNAS. And if you are so inclined, you can support the ministries of the church by going to hastingsnas.org/give. Hope you enjoy this sermon. Grace and peace.
Listen to the gospel from John chapter 11 for us this morning. Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. Mary was the one who anointed the Lord with perfume and wiped his feet with her hair. Her brother Lazarus was ill, so the sister sent a message to Jesus. Lord, he whom you love is ill. But when Jesus heard it, he said, this illness does not lead to death. Rather, it is for God's glory, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Accordingly, though Jesus loved Martha and her sister Lazarus, after having heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, let us go to Judea again. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews were just now trying to stone you, and are you going there again? Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours of daylight? Those who walk during the day do not stumble because they see the light of this world, but those who walk at night stumble because the light is not in them. After saying this, he told them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I am going there to awaken him. The disciples said to him, Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will be all right. Jesus, however, had been speaking about his death, but they thought that he was referring merely to sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus is dead. For your sake, I am glad I was not there so that you may believe. But let us go to him. Thomas, who is called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go that we may die with him. When Jesus arrived, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now, Bethany was near Jerusalem, some 2 miles away. And many of the Jews who had come to Martha and Mary to console them about their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, while Mary stayed at home. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that God will give you whatever you ask of him. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one coming into the world. When she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary and told her privately, the teacher is here and is calling for you. And when she heard it, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus, who had not yet come to the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him, the Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary get up quickly and go out. They followed her because they thought she was going to the tomb to weep there. When Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she knelt at his feet and said to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was greatly disturbed in spirit and deeply moved. He said, where have you laid him? They said to him, Lord, come and see. Jesus began to weep. So the Jews said, see how he loved him. But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? Then Jesus, again greatly disturbed, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. Jesus said, take away the stone. Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, Lord, already there's a stench because he has been there for 4 days. Jesus said to her, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone, and Jesus looked upward and said, Father, I thank you for having heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I have said this for the sake of the crowd standing here so that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said this, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. The dead man came out, his hands and feet bound with strips of cloth and his face wrapped in a cloth. Jesus said to them, unbind him and let him go. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary had seen what Jesus did, believed in him. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the world. Amen. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. Church, you ever feel like you have those days where everything's working against you? Yeah, this isn't part of the sermon. That's today, okay? I would covet your prayers as I preach this morning. Is it all right if I talk about the church budget for a minute? Now I am in the sermon, just FYI. And aren't you proud of me for reading the scripture before I preached this week? Can I talk about the budget for a moment? This is the sermon, and I want to start by talking about the church budget. Because we do something a little bit different when we create our annual budget here at Hastings Church of the Nazarene. When we create our budget, we actually, believe it or not, create it from the future. That might sound strange, so let me explain it. And let me qualify this also by saying that this is something that Pastor Justin brought this to us. So, like, it's really all on his shoulders, not mine. But the budget is created in this way. We look forward. We look back at our previous years. We take that into account, but then we look forward at what is to come, and we create a budget that reflects where we anticipate that we are moving. We want our budget to be defined by where we are going. Based on the trajectory of where we've come, we look forward to where we're going to go. And so we always want to budget a little bit more than what we brought in last year. This is really exciting stuff, I know. But rather than reducing our budget from the previous year, our aim is to increase the budget a little bit when we write it at the beginning of every year. And this is for a lot of reasons, but one of the main ones is that this gives us a goal. This gives us an aim, something we can look to, something that we can be working towards. It gives us something we can anticipate. We want our budget to be anticipatory, defined by where we anticipate being a year from now, rather than being defined by where we were a year ago. And we certainly take the past into account. That's certainly important. We don't ignore where we've come from, but from there, we base the budget on where we think God will take us in the future. We let the future determine, define, and set our budget. And I believe that's a healthy approach. I think it's a good way to look about going about our budget. But then something really fun happens when you're in the middle of your fiscal year, maybe coming towards the end of your fiscal year at the end of May, and it's looking like you're not going to hit your budget. And to be frank, this year looks like it's going to be a year that we don't hit our anticipated budget, which we did increase it a little bit from where we were last year, trying to look forward. And I think I can say this with confidence, that I think this is the first year that it's looking like we're not going to hit our budget. I could be wrong about that, don't quote me, but it's looking like we're not going to raise what we projected for this year, and that's interesting, because do you know what happens when things don't go as you plan? God works. Yeah, God does. But do you know what I do? I don't know about you, but we blame. Now, I won't speak for the board. I'll speak for myself today. When I look at how it's looking like we might not hit our budget this year, we've got a few months left. When we look at why we're not going to hit our budget, I'm not going to speak for the board. Do you know what I do? I blame. And do you know what the easiest thing to blame is? The economy. This amorphous non-entity, right? This thing that literally no one understands. I heard an interview with Bill Gates, and this interviewer asked Bill Gates, if there's one thing you wish you could understand that you don't understand, what would it be? And he said, I wish I could understand economics. This thing that no one actually understands, but yet has all this power over our lives, right? When giving dips, do you know what the first thing I blame is? Look at the economy. Higher interest rates. More expensive gas. More expensive groceries. That's an easy thing to do. And, you know, maybe there's some reality there, but then I look at the consumer spending index. I look at how much people are actually spending. And economists have been baffled because we've had this impending recession we've been hearing about for quite a while now. That is going to happen. We're going to hit a recession. We're going to go into this another recession like we did in 2008. And one of the indicators for that is how much are people going to spend? And all the economists have been saying, look for the dip in spending. Guess what? There's no dip. We're spending as much, if not more, than we were a year or 2 years ago. People are still going on vacations. People are still eating out at restaurants. I don't know about you. If you go out to a restaurant, there are very few restaurants where you can get in without a wait. At least in Grand Rapids, it's inflation is real. I'm not denying that. But what is also real is that people are spending. People are buying. Go try to find a PlayStation on the shelf at Walmart. It ain't there. Go try to find a new computer. You're going to be waiting. Consumer spending is up. So if I can't blame this thing that has no actual existence apart from its influence on us, the economy, which is an easy thing to do because it doesn't have a face, it doesn't have a voice, well then maybe, I'm not stepping on anybody's toes, I just want you to know this, maybe I should blame young people. That's the next natural thing I should blame. You know, I don't know how much people give. It is a practice of mine that I do not look at how much any person or any family is giving. That is intentional on my part. The denomination, our polity, gives me the authority to do that. I do not exercise it. I don't want to know. But we are growing younger here at Hastings NAS. We've been growing younger for quite a few years now. And statistically, I don't know because I don't look, younger people give less to churches than older people. That's just statistics. So maybe I can put the blame there. But then I see the investment of our young families, and I know our young families, and even though I don't look at how people give, I trust that God is working in people's lives. Now, maybe you all have a very good reason to not give. Maybe we all just have good reasons. But maybe if I can't blame the economy and if I can't blame what statistics say that as we're growing young, giving is going down because young people just don't give, well then, if I'm in a rather self-loathing mood, do you know what I do? She said, blame the old ones. No. I blame myself. Well, it's my fault, obviously. I'm the lead pastor. It falls on my shoulders. I bear the burden. I'm not able to cast a compelling vision for our church. Not well enough. I'm not able to visit people in the ways that I ought. You know, I can turn the blame inside. Well, obviously, if giving is down, then that means I'm not doing my job. And it ultimately falls on my shoulders. If because giving dips, I have to take a pay cut, or if because giving dips, we have to have hard conversations about staffing salaries, which are, you know, already a joke. We're not, by the way, we're not having those conversations. That's just hypothetical, and that's what I do when I catastrophize. But when we're faced with pain, frustration, and fear, we can turn to blame. Maybe you don't, but I do. What was really interesting was that in our text this morning, in John chapter 11, what we see happening with Mary, Martha, and even the Jews, what do they do when they confront Jesus? They blame him. In this long gospel reading, did you catch that? After Lazarus dies, both women and then also the Jews who follow after Mary approach Jesus and they say to him, Mary and Martha say directly to him, they say, Jesus, if you had only been here, if you had only been here. Martha at least says, but I know God will give you whatever you ask. Mary doesn't. Mary says, Jesus, if you had been here. And then the Jews turn to each other and say, hey, this guy, he cured the blind. Couldn't he have healed him? They blame. Sociologist Brené Brown says that blame is a way that we discharge pain and anger. And I would add to that list fear. We discharge our pain and our anger and our fear through blame. You know what that means? That means after walking on the carpet for 5 minutes wearing woolly socks, you walk over to your wife and you just boop her on the nose. I don't do that. What are you doing? You're discharging this static electricity. That discharge is a sharing of this electric current with another person. And guess what? It's shocking. It's painful. And this is what blaming is. It is taking our hurt, our anger, our frustration, our pain, our fear, and it is thrusting it upon another person. Saying, hey, I can't carry this. You carry it. And guess what? It's shocking. And it's painful. Maybe you can deal with this pain. It's an offloading of our burden. That's what blame is. And church, I want to tell you, if you're blaming someone for something, if I'm blaming someone for something, if we are blaming someone for something, maybe we need to take a beat, take a step back, and ask ourselves, what am I discharging? What anger am I unloading onto someone else? What fear am I passing on to someone else in an unhealthy way? Jesus, if you had only been here, where were you? We told you he was sick. And what I love so much about this story is how Jesus responds. You see, in their hurt and in their pain, they blame Jesus, which is a way of saying, hey, I can't carry this by myself. So let me tell you, I can't carry it by myself in an unhealthy way. But Jesus doesn't take this time to correct them. He doesn't take this opportunity to teach them a lesson. He doesn't get hurt or indignant with their blame, because blame is just an unhealthy way of saying you want someone to join you in your pain. Discharging your pain and anger might not be a bad thing to do, but maybe blame isn't the right way to do it. Jesus knows they don't need correction. Jesus knows they need someone to grieve with them. You see, Jesus sees their blame and responds by seeing what is really happening under the surface. They're grieving, and they don't have a way to ask Jesus to enter into that pain with them. Their brother Lazarus has died unexpectedly. Blame is an unhealthy discharge, but there is a healthy one as well. See, instead of saying, Jesus, if you'd only been here, they could have said, Jesus, we are grieving. We're upset. We're hurt. And quite frankly, we're a little upset with you. We felt dismissed. Will you grieve with us? Can you share this with me? Because I'm feeling the weight. They don't say that. And yet, that's what Jesus sees. So what is Jesus' response to the grief of these sisters? He weeps. As he goes, he weeps before he gets to the tomb. He weeps because of the grief of his close friends. He weeps because of the death of his dear friend. And he weeps because of death itself. You see, I think he weeps because death is. Full stop. I think part of the reason Jesus weeps is because death is not God's intended reality for us. I think Jesus weeps because death is not what God desires for humanity. And in the death of his good friend, someone who he had stayed with at every trip to Jerusalem, Jesus is confronted with his great nemesis. Jesus is confronted with that force that he knows will do to him what it did to Lazarus. So in an unhealthy way, Mary and Martha tell Jesus that they need him to enter their grief. And so he does. He enters their grief with them. And he weeps literal tears. I don't know that we can grasp the magnitude of that one little verse, he began to weep. Jesus enters into their grief because Jesus is the best of us. Jesus enters their grief not because Jesus was fully divine. Jesus enters their grief because Jesus was fully human. You see, we have a tendency to think that Jesus was who he was because he was God. And yes, that's true. But we can look to Jesus and we can say, well, yeah, Jesus can do that. He's God. That's an ancient Christian heresy, by the way. It's an ancient Christian heresy called Docetism to say that, well, Jesus could do that because he was God, and I can't because I'm not God. Because while it is true that Jesus was fully God, we cannot neglect that Jesus was also fully human. The math doesn't add up here. 100% God, 100% human. You see, Jesus was who he was because he was like us. You see, last week I called Jesus the proto-human. And I like that way of phrasing it. By that I mean that Jesus is the fullest example of what it means to be a human being. You want to know what it means to be a human being? Well, look to Jesus. You see, what comes to mind when I talk about the golden standard? Nobody? The golden standard? Oh, man. You guys need to eat more McDonald's. The golden standard is McDonald's French fries. Is this news? I had that written in my sermon because I thought everybody would like, that was like a relatable moment in the sermon, you know? Like the way that you write a sermon is like you will weave things in that will kind of bring people back after maybe some heavier stuff. So I've been talking about kind of some heavy stuff and I was like, oh, let's have some levity in the sermon. Let's talk about French fries. Caught you off guard with the golden standard. It's the golden standard. McDonald's French fries are the golden standard. We call them the golden standard because they're the measurement for every other French fry. You know, they may not be your favorite French fry. They're not Rallies or Checkers. But they are how we determine if other fries are good or not. Oh, these fries are good. Are they better than McDonald's? Are they worse than McDonald's? Do they stand up to the golden standard? You can use that from now on, by the way. There's the levity. Is this one better or worse than McDonald's? You see, French fries from McDonald's are the proto fry. Amen. They are the fry by which we determine what every other fry is. That's what Jesus is. He's the proto-human. That's what we mean when we call him the proto-human. He is the standard. You want to know what humanity looks like? You know what humanity in its fullness is? Well, it's Jesus. He is what it means to be human. You see, I don't think we fully grasp that Jesus was a fully human being like you and like me. Do you know what it means that Jesus was fully human in this text? It means that sorrow and grief and anguish and suffering are not an aberration to our humanity. This means that weeping is not a problem. means that grief is not a weakness. This means that suffering and being affected by other people and sharing in their pain is completely holy. It's completely holy. It means that being sad and grieving the death of a loved one is holy. It means you don't need to be strong or hold it together. I think we tend to think that we need to have this stoic personality in the face of grief to be unaffected. No, we'd rather be strong. We'd rather keep it together. We'd rather hold it in. But church, I'm telling you right now, twice in this text it says that Jesus was disturbed. Disturbed. I almost titled the sermon today, Disturbed Faith. The text says that Jesus was disturbed, so moved, so grieved, because things were not as they ought to have been. To be disturbed is to recognize disorder. And death is a disorder of God's intent. Jesus was grieved and he was so disturbed by the death of his good friend that he wept. As the fullness of humanity, Jesus wept. Which means that you can weep too. It means that you can grieve too. It means that your grief might be holy. How well do we grieve, church? How well are we about being honest about the things that cause us pain and anger and fear? Or would we rather just blame? Would we rather just discharge our pain? Would we rather avoid that which is grieving us? Skirt around it. You know, our Lenten resource, our spiritual guide this year, is called The Way Through on Purpose. Because it's not the way around. It's the way through our grief, our anguish. You see, Jesus doesn't avoid the source of his pain. He actually asks them to be taken to the tomb. Where has he been laid? Take me to him. You catch that? Jesus faces his grief head on. He goes to the tomb. So I want to know, church, where are your tombs? Where are the places where death has been rearing its ugly head in your life? Maybe literally. I think today of James Pickett, who I talked to yesterday about the death of his sister, 52, in a murder attempted suicide. That's not the way it's supposed to be. Jesus is disturbed. Think about just a few months ago, Michigan State University. That's not the way it's supposed to go. Jesus is disturbed. Maybe it's not literal death. Maybe it's relational death. Divorce. Abandonment. Abuse. Trauma. Neglect. Where's your tomb? Have you been avoiding them? Ignoring that source of grief? Have you discharged what those tombs have brought you in a way that places it on other people? Well, let me tell you right now, church, The one who reveals to us what it means to be a full human being does not avoid the tomb. Whether it's the tomb of his best friend Lazarus, or whether it's his own tomb. The proto-human does not. See, what if by avoiding and ignoring and dismissing those moments and experiences of death in our life, what if we are then also avoiding and ignoring and dismissing the resurrection power of Jesus in our life also? See, we all want to participate in the resurrection life of Jesus, amen? Yeah, that's good news, isn't it? But guess what precedes the resurrection? Jesus faces death head on. He goes to the tomb and he looks at Lazarus and he looks at death face to face. And he faces his own grief head on. And do you know what his response to facing death is? Do you know what he does in the midst of this grief? He looks in the tomb and he shouts, "Lazarus, come out! Get out of death!" You see, he raises Lazarus from the dead. How can Jesus do that? How can Jesus stare death directly in the face? How can Jesus say that he is the resurrection? You see, it might be a little bit late to introduce something new into the sermon, and I'm wrapping up here, I promise. But Jesus can face the source of his grief, that which causes him to weep, because he knows that God's future is more defining than the past. See, here's the new thing I want to introduce into the sermon, this late into the sermon. You see, we are so frequently defined by our past in one of two ways. We can be defined by our past through nostalgia. 90s styles are back. Like baggy jeans. Like I want to bring my JNCOs back out. Nostalgia is a strong force. And it's saying, boy, I wish we could go back to the way things were. Man, I wish we could go back to simpler times. I wish that we could, you remember that period of our life? Why can't we just go back to like it was back then? We're being defined by what was in a nostalgic way. I want to go back to the way things were. Or the other way that we can be defined by our past is through trauma. Which is not saying, man, I wish we could go back to that time. That instead is saying, man, I wish we would never experience that again. I wish I could undo what was. I wish that thing never happened to me. You see, in both of these circumstances, whether it's nostalgia or whether it's trauma, it is our past that is defining and shaping us. Jesus is not defined by the past reality, whether it's nostalgia or trauma. In this case, it's traumatic. No, Jesus is defined by the promise of his Father's future. Father, I know that you hear me. I knew that you would hear me. Jesus is defined by the promise of God's future. Jesus is the resurrection. Jesus doesn't perform resurrection. He is resurrection. Which is why Lazarus is raised from the dead. Now, spoiler alert, he's going to die again. Okay? Lazarus isn't hanging out in Bethany 2 miles outside of Jerusalem right now. He is raised, but he's not resurrected to the new creation. See, and in his being raised, what we see then is a breaking in of God's future. God's intention for creation is not death and destruction and decay and disorder. So let me break that into your present right now. See, I don't know about you, but sometimes my past can manifest itself in some ways in my life. My experiences can show up, and Kayla says, "Why'd you do that?" And I say, "Oh, geez. I guess I'm dealing with something I didn't know I was dealing with. My past is manifesting in mostly unhealthy ways is how it shows up. So what I want to say is that if our own pasts can determine how we act and interact and what animates us and how we behave, well then, why can't God's future also be an animating force for us? Why is what has happened to us more significant in how we interact with each other than what God has for us to come? You see, Jesus was animated and motivated by the future promise of resurrection. Lazarus, come out! Which means that, guess what? We can be too. We can be animated. We can be motivated. We can be defined by what God has for us, a promise of new creation. Not defined by the trauma or the nostalgia of our past, defined instead by the goodness of God's intended future. Church, you can have a faith that is defined more by God, by what God has for you than by what your trauma did to you. Because of their own woundedness, both Mary and Martha blame Jesus. Because of their wounding, they attempt to wound him. Isn't that what we do? What's the saying? Hurt people, hurt people. Because of our own hurt, because of our own trauma, because of our own abuse, we are then prone to hurt other people. We are prone to traumatize others. We become perpetrators of that which was perpetrated against us. I'll tell you right now, I could share stories of the ways that I have weaponized my own hurt against other people. And I'll tell you, it took me a long time before I realized that's what I was doing. Because I had been formed by my own trauma, rather than being formed by God's promised goodness. We try to build our budget on what the future holds for us. So what we want to do here at the church, we want to build our budget based on what we believe God is doing in us and through us. Maybe we should also do that in our own lives. What is God's future for you? Tell you right now, God's future is not a future of anguish. God's future is not a future of abuse. God's future is not a future of suffering. God's future is not a future of neglect. Church, God's future is a future of grace and compassion, kindness, gentleness, you know, the fruit of the Spirit. When you read Revelation, you read there is no night there. Weeping is no more. Death is gone. God's intended future is a future that is good. Church, you got some hurt in your life? You got some past? You have a past with some moments of deep pain? Well, then grieve them well. You see, Jesus grieves the past death of Lazarus. Jesus wept. You can too. But also know that you don't have to operate from your source of pain. Your pain is real. Your experiences are valid, but we don't have to operate from them. They don't have to be our definition. They are real, but God's future can be our defining reality. This means that just because you have hurt, it doesn't mean that you need to then be the one who hurts others. Because God's future is a future of grace and compassion and justice and mercy, which means that we too can be a people of grace and justice and compassion and mercy. We can be forgiving because God's future is a future of forgiveness. We can show mercy even in the face of no mercy because God's future is a future of mercy. We can show gentleness even if our own life tells us that gentleness is weakness. Even if our own experience tells us that gentleness is not manly enough. Even if our own history tells us that gentleness will get you wounded, we can be gentle. Why? Because God's future is a future of gentleness. We can be formed by what will be just as much as we can be formed by what has been. This is the good news of Jesus Christ for the people of God today.